welcome back to another episode here at the Damage Report. Very excited for today. A combination of two things. One is the mix of news we have. We're going to be talking about things like the future of the filibuster, the future of taxes, the future of whether you get to vote or not in a couple different states. That's always fun. And what does Tucker Carlson think about Cardi B? So lots of important substance here. But in addition to that, we've got something equally important. Benjamin Dixon, who returns the show. Ben, how's it going?
It's going great, John. Thanks for having me, man.
Benjamin Dixon is, I think case could be made, the hardest working man in online news. What have you done so far today already?
Well, I'm currently premiering a video on Facebook and about Mitch McConnell, because that broke after my morning show this morning. So, yeah, and then I'm here with you.
And so you've already done your morning show?
Yeah, yeah. We started.
How long is your morning show?
It's about 2 hours.
Jesus.
Give or take.
Like you remind me of a young Cenk Uygur, just hour after hour. I don't know how you do that. But we do appreciate you being here. We've got a lot of important news. I know you might have touched on some of this. We're gonna try to put a different spin on it, perhaps.
Oh yeah.
And keep it interesting for you and for the audience. And speaking of the audience, thank you for being out there, regardless of what platform you're on. Really do appreciate it. It would be a tremendous help if you would hit the like button, share the stream so that people know we're live. You know what? It's so helpful, I'm even gonna remember to do it. I'm gonna tweet out about this in a second. But anyway, please do that. And if you'd like to interact with us, you can ask us questions, leave comments, things like that. And we will respond as we go along. I did wanna let you know that following the show today on Twitch, twitch.tv/TYT, there will be the latest episode of Deep Dive with Jordan Yule. And it's gonna be diving, sometimes diving solo, sometimes with company. He's got a pool buddy today. Guest is Sunny Singh, aka Hate56, and Gabe Bryant of Black Philly Radical Collective are gonna be joining Jordan Yule on Deep Dive. So you can expect that after the Damage Report. So definitely stay around for that. Thank you to everybody who just made that hype train so successful on Twitch. And with that, Ben, what do you say? Why don't we jump into the news?
Let's do it, man.
Okay, let's do it. Earlier today, Senate Minority Leader, I'm never gonna get sick of saying that, Mitch McConnell took to the floor to speak up in defense of the filibuster, mostly through threatening the Democrats with what will happen if they reform it in literally any way. But first, before he threatens the Democrats, he wants to kind of insult the voters a little bit and talk about what they were and weren't voting for in the last couple of elections. So here he is.
Does anyone really believe the American people were voting for an entirely new system of government by electing Joe Biden to the White House and a 50-50 Senate? This is a 50-50 Senate. There was no mandate to completely transform America by the American people on November 3rd. That may be what a few liberal activists want, but does anyone believe that millions of Americans thought that's what they were electing? Of course not.
God, he's boring. Anyway, Ben, there's a few things there that I take issue with. When it comes to reform of the filibuster, which he's pitching as an entirely new system of government, I would say that that's more what those who tried to overthrow our government a couple months ago were working for. Right. He pitches that as a sort of fundamental change to everything. Is this what do you think the people were voting for on November 3rd or in those special elections?
A fundamental change in the direction that this country has been going in for quite some time. I mean, if you really just look at the actual mandate, you look at Georgia. The people came out twice in Georgia for specific things. And these are the specific things that Mitch McConnell and the Senate Republicans are going to stand in the way are, namely HR1. The need for that bill to come to the Senate and to be able to be passed so that we can maintain and expand our voting rights. This is the number one thing that they're going to try to block with the filibuster. So, you know, every time we have an election, the other side tries to claim that there is no mandate, but Republicans have shown that they don't ever require a mandate to execute their hyper-conservative agenda, namely that 2017 $2 trillion package of tax giveaways they gave to the Republicans, to billionaires and millionaires.
I mean, they claimed a mandate following 2016 when he lost the popular vote by millions.
Right.
And I just, you know, I want to ask, I love asking pointless questions because they are asked sort of presupposing a world where anyone is actually acting in a intellectually honest fashion, which is not what Mitch McConnell is doing. But I want to ask, what do the people have to do to send the signal that they actually want something to be done, that they want the government to function, to identify problems and fix them? Because, you know, more of them voting for the Democrat versus Trump in 2016 didn't send that signal. The string of special election victories apparently didn't send that signal. Flipping the House in 2018 and electing the best progressives we've had, you know, in decades and decades didn't send the signal. Right. Beating Trump for re-election didn't send the signal. Winning two simultaneous special elections in Georgia of all places didn't send the signal. So what are we supposed to do? Like, what can the people say to indicate that we think the government should function for something other than demonizing immigrants and giving tax breaks to wealthy people? Like, we think that it should have some other function. And at this point, obviously, again, he's not being intellectually honest, but I don't know what legitimate signal could be sent other than we want the government to do something.
Abolishing the filibuster, right? That's it at this point, because that's what they have used for years to maintain the tyranny of the minority, right? And when they get in power, they have no problem using reconciliation to pass any draconian policies that they want to pass. They have no problem ignoring the will of the people, have no problem ignoring the input of Democrats. They do what they want to do. And because the Democrats have this undue amount of respect for that institution, the institution of the filibuster, which is not constitutional, by the way, what needs to be done is to repeal or to abolish rather the filibuster so stuff can get done. That's really the only move at this point.
Exactly. Now, Mitch McConnell wants you to be very scared about a possible whatever amount of reform to the filibuster. And so a lot of his comments earlier today were envisioning this future where the Republicans all of a sudden would exercise power. So here is what that looked like.
As soon as Republicans wound up back in the saddle, we wouldn't just erase every liberal change that hurt the country. We'd strengthen America with all kinds of conservative policies with zero input from the other side. How about this? Nationwide right to work for working Americans. Defunding Planned Parenthood in sanctuary cities on day one. A whole new era of domestic energy production. Sweeping new protections for conscience and the right to life of the unborn. Concealed carry reciprocity in all 50 states and the District of Columbia. Massive hardening of security on our southern border. So the pendulum, Mr. President, would swing both ways.
I've never been so bored by a description of the apocalypse. Protections for conscience.
Our goal over the next 4 years is to ensure that President Obama is one term.
Oh God, like just kill me. You're boring me to death. That's too slow. So anyway, and by the way, do you believe that Mitch McConnell cares about half of those things? Like,
I just want real concealed carry reciprocity. I care about, he doesn't care about guns. He cares about money and judges. That's all he cares about. Yeah.
But anyway, so this is the big thing. And it's not just Mitch McConnell saying they'll do all this stuff. A lot of Democrats who don't want to reform the filibuster use effectively that as the reason not to, Ben. So when you hear that, how scared are you? And is that a reason not to reform the filibuster?
Yeah, I'm cut from a different cloth, man. Like, do it then, Mitch. You know, that's what they're gonna do. Like, I don't take threats lightly. You know, and this is a list of threats. And I think this should all be sound bites, right? He's threatening a nationwide right to work. Okay. Tell that to all the unions, tell that all to the blue collar labor, tell that to the folks in the different states that are clinging on to the idea that they can join together in a union to get some type of benefit from their labor. See, he's threatening every group in America. So I'm like, all right, show us, tell us what you, but in return, Democrats can't be timid. They have to actually play hardball, which means abolish the filibuster, get your version of HR 1 passed through the Senate, And in doing so, you all but ensure Republicans can't get elected ever again, because Republicans' only pathway to victory now is to disenfranchise millions of Americans. So let's do it.
Yeah, there's still, you know, in theory, possibly the conservative supermajority in the Supreme Court could totally destroy HR1, but that we have to at least try that. We have to at least get to that point. And here's the interesting thing, and maybe this buttresses Ben's point about how difficult it would be for them to actually win. The main issue for Republicans is that they don't run on things that are popular. If they did, people would want to vote for them, and they wouldn't have to try to stop as many people from voting as possible. And I think a great demonstration of that would be, you just heard this long list of changes that Mitch McConnell would like to make. Did they run on those? Like, is that what Trump was running on? Like speeches about nationwide right to work. We have to have it, everyone. Reciprocity for concealed carry. Yeah, let's do that. Millions want it. No, there's some conservatives like that stuff, sure. But is that a platform that can actually win you a national election? Clearly not, because they can't win national elections. They certainly can't get a majority of the voters to support them in that regard. And in an increasing number of states, like in Georgia, even in red states, that sort of stuff isn't winning elections to the extent that they're even running on any issues anyway. Like, they imply that the American people would love all of these changes, and yet they don't campaign like it. They don't run ads based on those sorts of things. They mostly just talk about satanic baby worship and or baby consumption and Dr. Seuss, and maybe something about Cardi B. And that's basically it. They imply to me that they don't have a lot of faith in their platform.
No, they absolutely don't. But I'm so glad he actually said that. And I think every single day for the next 3.5 years, they need to run commercials saying what the Republican agenda really is. And this is where they have always been going. In fact, this is the direction that they're going. It's not as though they haven't made concerted efforts to that direction in the first place, right? And so by trying to make us intimidated, saying that we're either going to do nothing in this country by virtue of not abolishing the filibuster and allowing the tyranny of the minority to maintain control of the Senate, saying that we can't get anything done, or if we dare try to get something done, then they're going to go scorch earth and do all of these draconian things that they've been wanting to do. To me, that's a perfect campaign ad to run every day for the next 4 years.
Yep. Two ads that should be run, that one and Kristen Sinema doing her little thumbs down. Those are ads that should run every day for the next few years.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called Un*** the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of Un*** the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today, and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Biden is coming off of his big COVID aid bill. What's the follow-up to that? Apparently, supposedly, maybe, tax hikes, actually. Bloomberg is reporting that Biden is planning, quote, the first major federal tax hike since 1993 in order to fund a long-term economic program designed to be the follow-up to his COVID relief bill. So we will talk about a lot of elements of this, including whether we're buying any of it. But supposedly, according to the reporting, some of the measures that are being considered that would raise taxes are things like raising the corporate income tax rate to 28% from 21%. Which is notably not where it was at before it was cut. Anyway, lifting the top tax rate to 39.6% from 37%. Well, don't kill him. Don't kill him, Biden. A whole 2%. Woo! He's a radical, baby. Anyway, taxing capital gains as ordinary income at a top tax rate of 39.6% for those earning more than $1 million a year, and hiking the estate tax rate to 45% from 40% for assets worth more than $1 million. So we're gonna get into the response from the right to some of these things. Spoiler alert, they think they're more radical than methinks they are. But anyway, Ben, what do you think about some of the things they're discussing as possibilities?
You know, it is the response from the right is going to be like clockwork. This is going to be Marxism to them, socialism, communism, Maoism. But these are just like minor changes. I do like the taxing capital gains like we tax income, which has been like a long-standing advantage that capital has had over labor forever in this country. And this is one of those things, like seriously, if they really think they're gonna get this done, they're gonna have to look at some structural changes in the Senate to even consider this.
Yeah, and notably taxing it as ordinary income, but only for people who make more than a million. So right. In theory, if you're working class or middle class, you can invest and still get the tax incentives. It's probably not gonna happen because the rich possess more than 90% of all the stocks in the country. But in theory, if you ever had money to do that, there would be a tax incentive to doing so. Now, some of the other things that are being discussed are more in the area of tax credits. A lot of it gets super specific and technical. We're not going in at that depth. We've done many videos about Biden's proposed tax plans in the past. But as a reminder, it includes things like temporarily increasing the child tax credit, expanding the child care credit, and fairly significantly so. For kids that are fairly young, it could take care of half or more of child care expenses. Forgiving student loan debt and excluding the forgiven amount from taxation. I believe as part of the COVID bill, actually, up until 2025, any amount that's forgiven is not going to be taxed, which is important because that would still be a tax. You'd still be paying for it. The issue with that is, every time I now see a reference, Ben, to them forgiving student loan debt, I just get angry because he could do it today. He could have done it yesterday. Saturday would have been great. And he didn't. So at a certain point, stop talking about things that you could have done that you haven't done. I'm not interested at some point. You excited me a little bit when you said that you were in support of it. Now it's just annoying to hear you talk about a thing that you clearly have little interest in actually doing.
Yeah, and it's just every time I hear it, it just reminds me how much this country is okay with saddling us with those economic chains, right? Because if the president of the United States could do this, that would be one of the greatest economic stimuluses packages this country has ever seen. But they are more committed to the bondage of debt than they are economic stimulus, to be quite honest with you.
Yeah, and look, whenever we get really critical of Biden, there's some people who think that we're being unfair or that we're jumping the gun. I mean, after all, he's only been president for a couple months or whatever. But again, why hasn't he done it? Like, okay, why hasn't he passed the Green New Deal? I get it, he's only been president for a little bit. But he could write up a little piece of paper and he could do his little signature. He wouldn't even have to answer questions from the press or anything. And he could cancel student loan debt. And he hasn't done it. And I would love to know, why hasn't the press asked the press secretary that? He said he would do it. He can do it. He hasn't done it. Why hasn't he done it? Seems like a simple question. Nobody's asking it, so we don't get any answers. And it seems consequential. As Ben pointed out, like that is one of the biggest forms of debt that's out there. And not equally distributed, by the way. Many of the people who are economically worst off also are worst off in that area. And yet they're not doing it. I get the feeling at some point, Ben, that it's like, pointing out that the checks are supposed to be $2,000. People just get annoyed when you remind them of things that suck, but I would love an answer personally.
Yeah, I would too, because I definitely get calls from Sally Mae to this day.
Now,
or they changed her name, but whatever she's called now.
That's true. Yeah, I think it starts with an A. I forget. But anyway, in addition, a lot of this is feeling to me like a football is being held out. And I'm thinking this time I'm really going to kick it. And I'm probably not, because we'll see. A lot of this sounds good. Is Joe Manchin going to support it though? Who knows? But one area where I get a little bit mad at the press that's sort of uncritically pretending that this is an option. Now, in this case, it's Fox Business. Their goal is to scare people about what Biden might do. But one thing they want you to feel for sure is possibly going to be included in this is the wealth tax. So Elizabeth Warren and other progressives unveiled legislation at the beginning of March that would tax the net worth of the wealthiest Americans. It's something that she's been talking about for a couple of years. The measure would impose a 2% annual tax on the net worth of US households above 50 million and would add an additional 1% levy on households worth more than 1 billion. And at that point, I mean, why even be rich, right? Anyway, so Janet Yellen was asked about this, the Treasury Secretary, and she said, that's something that we haven't decided yet and can look at. Now, no. I'm gleeful about being wrong about my predictions, but I feel pretty confident in this case. Joe Biden is not supporting, let alone pushing for, a wealth tax like that. And there ain't no way that Kristen Sinema, Joe Manchin, probably at least a half dozen others, if not a full dozen, are gonna support that. I love that she's talking about it, but the idea that like Janet Yellen's really doing the prep to put it into effect, Ben, I don't think so. What do you think?
Yeah, no, I wishful thinking. I don't mind going on, you know, daydreams about how we could change this country, but that's a non-starter for definitely Sinema, definitely for Manchin, and probably a lot more Democrats who would be able to hide behind those committed, those eight who voted against the $15 an hour. You can guarantee they would never support a wealth tax.
Yeah. Well, look, the thing about this is that we may question how much Biden is actually gonna push for this or how it would actually be done. Would it need to be reconciliation? Answer yes. Could it be? I don't know. Let's find out what the parliamentarian thinks. But what we do know is that a lot of this is very popular. Like, these are among the most popular positions. Taxing the wealthy, providing tax relief for those who need it most. That's very popular. And so, of course, the Republicans are going to be very much against it. So what do the Republicans think about Biden's plans to raise some taxes, maybe? Well, they're being very reasonable about it. You know, raising the top tax rate like 2%, or as Trish Regan calls it, socialism. It's going up 2%, man. It used to be way higher. Was it socialism then? Was it socialism for decades as our economy was like expanding by leaps and bounds? And if so, then that seems like a good thing. But remember, Trish Regan is the one who was actually kicked off of Fox News because what she said about COVID was too crazy even for Fox. But it's socialism. You've also got Lauren Boebert saying Biden is now planning a tax hike as if the prices of gas soaring and the food prices going up weren't enough. The middle class is getting hammered right now. Well, then it's a good thing that the taxes aren't on the middle class. But bear in mind, in this case, she knows that she's playing dumb. She's also dumb, but she's playing dumb too. And so, Ben, this is the rhetorical environment that the next couple of months, if there is a national debate about taxes, is going to be conducted in. We're even raising it a couple points. Is socialism? They're going to pretend that it applies to people that they don't, in the same way that they pretended that the Trump tax cuts were beneficial to those same groups. So this sounds like it's going to be fun.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's going to be the standard thing. But we have a small advantage that the pendulum is swinging a little bit more to the left. The Overton window is a little bit further to the left. I think the conversation that started with Occupy Wall Street all the way through Bernie Sanders' two campaigns, taxing the millionaires and the billionaires, with very simplistic language, I think we could push back against the propaganda that would be coming from somebody like Boebert, who's saying that this is a tax hike on middle class. Well, no, this is a tax hike on Jeff Bezos, right? This is a tax hike on Bill Gates. Like, we could really get specific with it, but far be it for Democrats to use some effective language.
Exactly. Now, look, they've come up with some ways to sort of simplify. They say no taxes on anyone making less than 400,000. That seems simple. We'll see if people actually get that message. What should help is that while we've been showing, like for instance, we showed Trish Regan, who used to be on Fox. You've got Laura Ingraham, very reasonable, saying that raising taxes by 2% is the road to serfdom. Jesus. What we should have at least, Ben, is one of their hosts in support of this and the most popular. So Tucker Carlson, remember, is a right-wing populist who hates the ruling class and the elites. And he's very critical of people like Jeff Bezos and other billionaires. So the fact that these taxes would only apply to those ruling elites and wouldn't hurt his working class, downtrodden, economic anxiety ridden base, it would help them, then surely he's gonna do night after night pushing for these tax cuts, right?
You would think.
You would think. Kind of doubt it. But he's someone we can work with anyway. Now, perhaps even crazier though, is there's a host of a show called Kudlow. Oh, it turns out his name is Kudlow. Anyway, so Kudlow, he has a theory for what you can do if you want the rich to get more taxes. And spoiler alert, it's not raising taxes. Take a look at his idea.
Fair share. The way you get upper income people to pay more in taxes is lower their tax rate. Not only will they have investment incentives, they will also have no tax avoidance.
The way you get them to pay more taxes, Ben, is lower their tax rate. Well, duh. Yeah.
Man, they're gonna try that trickle down economics until the end of the universe, right? That's the same thing that Ronald Reagan believed, and we have seen. I mean, the evidence has come out, and who cares about evidence? Obviously, Republicans don't. That nothing ever trickles down, and that's the same talking point. And we're gonna hear a resurgence in that if the conversation shifts any more towards raising taxes. We're gonna hear that theory over and over and over again.
Yeah, that was obviously like a stupid point. It's consistent. They've been saying that for decades, despite the lack of evidence, as you pointed out. But my favorite part, I think, at the end was he was like, "You'll also get more because there won't be tax avoidance."
Right.
Why would there be less? What, like if we cut their taxes even more, then they would, out of the goodness of their heart, stop ripping us off, stop transferring their funds overseas. Why are they doing it now? Trump cut their taxes a ton. Did they stop ripping us off then, Kudlow? I don't know. Yeah. Anyway, I'm glad that in theory it's something that Biden is gonna be pushing for. I don't have particularly high hopes. I think that Biden hasn't yet shown a willingness or ability to sort of railroad some of the more conservative Democrats in the Senate. You know, they haven't shown yet that they're willing to actually get rid of the filibuster. There are just so many roadblocks potentially to getting this done. And like, I understand that they just did the COVID aid bill, and so it might make some people think, well, they're capable of doing big things. That was COVID aid bill, man. It's in the middle of a pandemic. They had been promising it so much that even for Democrats, it would have been too difficult to go back on that, I guess. Yeah. I don't know. Texas seems set to join some of the other states that rapidly move to restrain voting rights as much as possible following the special elections in Georgia and the November results. We got more than two dozen GOP sponsored election bills under consideration in just Texas, by the way. Over 200 nationally, two dozen here in Texas. As lawmakers seek to tighten ID requirements and voter rolls, limit early voting, and up the penalty for errors. And that may be one of the most interesting ones, actually. So we're gonna circle around to those penalties for errors. But the state senator, Brian Hughes, is sort of point man on this, a Republican who chairs the State Affairs Committee and introduced a 27-page omnibus bill with several new restrictions and penalties, says that the 2020 election increased interest in legislation Texas lawmakers were already keen on, which is sort of just admitting it. No, dummy, you're supposed to pretend that people's concern about democracy is why we have to do it. Ben, he's just admitting, no, they already wanted to do it. Now they've just got a little bit more cover to start fighting back in Texas.
Yeah, no, this is they're saying the quiet parts out loud, and they're a lot more emboldened than you would expect for a party that's been roundly defeated. And this is, I think this is the next evolution of Trumpism. While Trump is out of power, they have the boldness to just say exactly what they're thinking, and who cares with the implications.
Yeah, they certainly don't have to worry about their voters. Like, no, it's not like Republicans in Texas are gonna see that and be like, hey, wait a second, I'm worried the party doesn't support democracy anymore.
Right, right. Yeah. I'm sorry, I don't mean to cut you off, but that's the other part, right? So long as they have just enough support in their own party, they will continue to push the envelope further and further in terms of disenfranchising people, in terms of their racism, in terms of their white supremacy. They, as long as they can keep enough to win their primaries, they'll go with anything.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And their voters just correctly understand that we get them into office and they'll do things that benefit us, or at least they'll think that they will. They'll mostly just distract them with cancel culture stuff while giving money to rich people. But they think that the Republicans have their back, and they value that a billion times more than vague philosophical concepts like democracy or anything like that. I don't know why the Republicans thought they had to pretend to support democracy a couple of years ago, but that's gone. Now, they all believe that there was fraud, even though importantly in Texas, the Attorney General Ken Paxton's office spent 22,000 hours looking for voter fraud and uncovered just 16 cases of false addresses on registration forms. That's out of nearly 17 million voters. So those people who accidentally put the wrong address are truly one in a million. But they're not gonna let a complete lack of voter fraud stop them from stopping people from voting. And so what forms are those gonna come in? Like with a lot of other states, many of the provisions would directly address creative ways that Texans voted during the pandemic, like overnight early voting and drive-through voting, as well as mail-in voting, which Trump particularly protested. Several bills also seek to ensure that non-citizens stay off the voter rolls and urge election officials to aggressively purge the rolls. And a slew of bills would add or increase penalties for fraud or mistakes made by voters or officials in running elections. Now, the fraud doesn't exist. We just demonstrated that. But potentially, there could be mistakes. They didn't find those either, but there could be. So here's what I think is one of the most interesting parts about the Texas version of this. In Hughes' election bill, which he said he expects will be the vehicle for any voting legislation coming out of the Senate, they would impose civil fines on local officials who don't purge their voter rolls quickly enough. $100 for every voter the Secretary of State's office identifies as improperly being on the books. Now, what's interesting about that, Ben, is that this investigation has shown that that isn't really a problem. But you'll note that they are fining $100 for every person improperly on the rolls.
Right.
How much are they fining for every person improperly taken off of the rolls?
Oh, nothing. You get a kickback, a rebate.
Yeah. So if you were in charge of this, Ben, which way would you err?
Well, so I'm just thinking about the time I was purged off the rolls in Florida back in 2004. And I'm just thinking about all the different ways over the years, the secretaries of states, particularly of red states, have been extremely aggressive in purging voters off the rolls. That said, this is it's almost like overkill, because in these states, you have extremely aggressive secretaries of states, and are actually, I'm sorry, not secretaries of states, but supervisors of elections in the different counties, who take it upon themselves to be vigilant about these things. Now, with this incentive, maybe he should have just flipped it and said, listen, for every person you get rid of, we give you $100. Because that's the only way I could see some of these Republican supervisors of elections actually doing more than what they're already doing. Mm-hmm. But I think they're just trying to create a chilling factor. What they're really trying to do is a chilling effect, and to intimidate not only any loose or maverick supervisor of election who actually wants to do the right thing, they're trying to create a chilling effect to intimidate them into carrying out the same type of suppression that we've seen relentlessly over the last couple of decades.
Exactly. And we can see this and know that it's almost certainly gonna pass in Texas, and the Texas governor would gladly do it. I mean, he personally got involved in trying to stop people to vote in the run up to November election. We covered that. And we know that this is gonna result in people being purged, whether opportunistically or to cover their ass. And we'll cover those stories in a year or two or 3 years. And what are you gonna do? They still control Texas. They can do what they want. The only thing they want to do is stop people from voting, like in Georgia, Arizona, and other places. They saw more participation as literally the worst thing that could have happened. And so you'll notice, by the way, that what are they focusing on? Which crisis in Texas? Is it what happened with the weather and access to power and all the people dying? No, it's people voting a couple of months before that. That's the thing that they have to hit as hard as they can.
Yeah. That's I mean, the future looks so grim when you consider the priorities of our politicians, right? They're not worried about how we survive as a species. They're not worried about how we survive climate change. They're not worried about 11-year-old boys who die from hypothermia in Texas in their trailer. They're worried about, you know, minorities voting them out of power.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, let's move to a slightly different angle on this, on a state not far from there. Will corporations be those that save us from the Republican Party stopping us from voting? I have my doubts, but we'll see what happens. We do have some first moves in Georgia in this area. So civil liberties groups are ratcheting up pressure on major corporations based in Georgia, including Coca-Cola, Affleck, Delta Airlines, Home Depot, and UPS, to oppose a Republican-led effort to make it harder to vote in the Peach State. They put out things like this. This is from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, asking those companies to stand up. And apparently it has succeeded, at least to some extent. Back on Friday, the advocates scored a win when the Georgia Chamber of Commerce issued a statement expressing, quote, concern and opposition to the measures under consideration in the legislature. Coca-Cola said it would, quote, work to advance voting rights and access in Georgia and across the country. Delta Airlines backed an election system that promotes broad voter participation, equal access to the polls, and fair, secure election processes. Home Depot, of all places, endorsed accessible, fair, and secure elections. I mean, that could just say that they support the Republican position, because that's the lie that the Republicans give. But Aflac and UPS touted a push for fairness and integrity. So now, in the past, there have been things that state legislatures have done that corporations have pushed back against, and they've gotten to reverse. So back in 2016, Georgia's Republican governor vetoed a so-called religious freedom bill after the business community, sports leagues, and civil liberties groups criticized it as being anti-gay. In 2019, though, a threatened Hollywood boycott failed to stall one of the nation's strictest anti-abortion bills, which was still signed into law by Republican Governor Brian Kemp. So a little bit of mixed success there on getting involved. What are your thoughts about this one?
You can't count on corporations to do anything but worry about their profits, right? Even Coca-Cola, you know, they're kind of getting a little mushy on whether or not they're going to stand with the voters of Georgia. And so for me, it's just a testament to the alignment. And Republicans know this. There's a lot of alignment between the ultimate goals of these corporations and the Republican agenda, which is to minimize their tax responsibility in this country. And so all of these ancillary things, all these things that are on the periphery, rather, they're significant to the extent that we can apply political pressure and economic pressure. And so until we can actually show them, and I think this is what a lot of people are doing, the New Georgia Project, Cliff Albright and Insay Ufad, they are applying, they're organizing to ensure that there's enough economic pressure so that they can feel the hurt.
And let's say that this initial statement actually represents that they're gonna do something. I mean, I feel like we know basically nothing about what that means or how significant it is. So you support voting rights access, blah, blah, blah. What does that mean in practice? Does it mean that you will put out a statement? Or does it mean that you will not donate money to anyone who votes in favor of these laws? Or will it mean that you will support candidates who will try to take down those who pass these laws? These are all things that, in theory, a corporation could do with their vast resources if they actually care about voting. Some of them are far, far, far more significant than others. And so far, I mean, granted, it's only been a little bit of time. Putting out a statement is super easy. Everybody can say that they want fair, secure elections. That's so simple that I don't even know which side that's meant to support, considering how many lies there are about this area. But will you put your resources where your PR statements are in terms of trying to take down all of the many Republicans? Because every Republican in the state is going to vote for these bills, HB 531 and SB 241. Are you actually going to do that? And that is where I have a lot more questions. And I guess we'll have to see. I assume activists are going to be really trying to define what these corporations are talking about.
And John, what's so frustrating about this, it's simultaneously frustrating, but also encouraging. It's frustrating that they're able to get away with this suppression. And every time they get away with it, organizers have to go out and register even more people. But it's encouraging because there's enough tenacity and enough willingness to just continue to fight the fight, that when they disenfranchised, I think it was 200,000 voters in the 2018 gubernatorial race with Stacey Abrams, they came back and registered 300,000, 400,000. And so it's frustrating, but it is encouraging because the people see what's happening and they're organizing.
You know, I'm glad that you brought up Stacey Abrams. Let's go to that, because you know, nobody's really surprised that following the elections, Republicans are trying to stop people in Georgia from voting. Stacey Abrams probably least of all is surprised by that. But she was on CNN talking recently about some of these most recent bills. So let's go to a bit of what she had to say.
They are going to end no excuse mail-in voting, which has been there since 2005. They're going to reduce voting on Sundays, ask for stricter ID requirements, take away drop boxes. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer in D.C., he called this effort by Georgia Republicans, quote, racist, plain and simple, unquote. Do you agree? And is there any way for Democrats to stop these efforts?
Well, first of all, I do absolutely agree that it's racist. It is a redux of Jim Crow in a suit and tie. We know that the only thing that precipitated these changes, it's not that there was a question of security. In fact, the Secretary of State and the governor went to great pains to assure America that Georgia's elections were secure. And so the only connection that we can find is that more people of color voted and it changed the outcome of elections in a direction that Republicans do not like. And so instead of celebrating better access and more participation, their response is to try to eliminate access to voting for primarily communities of color. And there's a direct correlation between the usage of drop boxes, the usage of in-person early voting, especially on Sundays, and the use of vote by mail, and a direct increase in the number of people of color voting.
Ben, what are your thoughts?
You know, she's absolutely right. I mean, but to a certain extent, her comments really don't make a lot of difference because they know they're being racist. Mm-hmm. That's the point. The point of it all is to try to maintain power on a system that has systemically disenfranchised black people in this country, marginalized communities, people of color, women, historically in this country. And this is one of their last salvos. This is the death pangs of white supremacy, is to cling to power by any means necessary. So she's making an astute point, but that's the whole point. The whole point is extension. What is voter suppression if not Jim Crow enduring?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're 100% right that they know what they're doing and why they're doing it. And beyond that, when you get into sort of when we discuss this, when we try to make sure that everybody knows what's going on, who are we attempting to persuade? I mean, clearly, I don't think that we're trying to like convince Republican voters, hey, they're lying to you. It's not about the voter fraud, it's about racism. I think they're pretty, I feel like they're pretty confident about that. I think that's kind of why they like it. And maybe in theory, you know, Trump told them there's fraud, so I guess they'll believe it. But we know what's going on. They're not going to like certain neighborhoods polls to harass voters because of specifically a fear of fraud there. That's not what it's about. Like best case scenario, some of the voters aren't supporting it for explicitly racist reasons. They're just totally cool with the racist stuff. They're just doing it because they believe that in the short term it will help them politically. But yeah, I have no doubts that they understand what's going on. I hope that in covering these sorts of things that we've been talking about, I mean, how many videos have we now done about in the past couple of months about these sorts of bills? It is that in the same way that they're going to attempt to get power by stopping people from voting, we have to get people fired up about the future of American democracy and actually care to fight for it, to support politicians who are going to do the opposite of these bills, that are going to fight for HR 1 or even better legislation in the future, that we're going to get people into office, they're going to put judges on the bench that will actually defend voting rights rather than providing eventual cover for bills like we're talking about in Texas and Georgia. The Republicans have their champions in the war against democracy. We need our own. And I don't know that there's a lot of Democratic voters that think a lot about voting rights and access and suppression and gerrymandering and all of that when they're getting involved politically. And I think it's a thing that needs to take up more of our time and attention.
Absolutely.
Yesterday, we talked about how Republican men don't want to take the vaccine and how that's such a mystery. Why don't they have faith in it? And we revealed that Tucker Carlson spent the past couple of months trying to convince them that there's nothing more patriotic than having an issue with the vaccine that Tucker Carlson almost certainly is going to take if he hasn't already had it, because he doesn't want to die from COVID. He's just ambivalent about whether it matters, whether his viewers actually die from it. Well, oddly enough, later that same night, he decided to double down on that. And here's what he had to say about vaccines.
So all of this should prompt some pretty tough questions for our public health experts in this country. And one of those questions is, how effective is this coronavirus vaccine? How necessary is it to take the vaccine? Don't dismiss those questions from anti-vaxxers. Don't kick people off social media for asking them. Answer the questions.
Okay, so Ben, I have a lot of thoughts about that. I will say really quickly, this is the go-to Tucker thing. I will not say that I'm a white supremacist, but I will do show after show saying, why is it so bad to be one? Why are you discriminating against them? I will not say that I believe in Q, but why is everyone being so mean to the QAnoners? And I won't say, don't take the vaccine, it'll kill you, or it's got laptop chips from Bill Gates in it. But why is everyone being so mean to the anti-vaxxers? It's just so see-through that he wants those people to feel warm and cozy as part of his audience. He's not gonna say anything that's gonna be too specific or disprovable, but he's gonna reassure all of the craziest people in the country that he's got their back.
You know, 530,000 people are dead from COVID-19. If the vaccine was only 50% efficient, which is not, it's highly efficient, I'd still be grateful for it and encourage people to take it because 530,000 people are dead. Tucker is a cancer on this country, and he gets paid extremely well to sow words that really have contributed to the death of so many people, to sow dissent, to sow discord, to sow white supremacy. And he does it with a smile and this look on his face like he's so confused. What I'm confused about is whether or not this guy even has a soul.
Mm-hmm. He spent more than a year doing whatever is necessary to produce an audience that's likely to get the disease and die from the disease. But we're the bad ones, the socialists. Anyway, There was a question from the audience, which is, why does he ask all these questions as a journalist rather than answering the questions? And that's really the theme of this video, and that's what I wanted to talk about. You know what Tucker Carlson loves? Asking dumb questions that we already have answers to, because he knows what the audience loves, which is we're just asking questions. As if they're interested in the information.
Right.
In the same way that the QAnon people say that they love doing research and yet never actually learn anything. It's weird how that works out. So here's the thing about Tucker Carlson and his show. He is not just a regular person, of whom I would be critical too, that they don't just Google things rather than asking dumb semi-rhetorical questions. But Tucker Carlson is a rich journalist with a massive platform. He's got a huge production team and probably multiple bookers working for him. If he wanted to get virtually anyone on his show, he could, including doctors, people who actually participate in the vaccine trials, the executives who are selling the vaccine, people in the Biden administration, the states that are distributing the vaccine, he could get all of them. And yet you'll note that he hasn't. Why is that? To ask a Tucker Carlson sort of question. He could do it, but why isn't he? Interesting. He didn't do that. He asks, how effective is it? Well, that information is freely available. And I'm just assuming that he wouldn't find it acceptable, the information that's already out there, in saying that he could have the actual people on. But we already know how effective it is, and we know how important it is, because as Ben pointed out, over 500,000 people have already died. So why is he asking a bunch of stupid questions that he already has answers to?
Because the answers undermine conservatism and their ideology and their worldview, and it would cause a level of cognitive dissonance that would cause their heads to explode for them to actually look in the mirror and realize that they have 100% been a part of the problem, that they have been the problem in this country that has led to 500,000 people dying. And so instead of confronting the truth, which is an inconvenient truth, they would rather just pose the question.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Dumb questions, because again, he doesn't want to say to his audience, don't take the vaccine, because then he could be criticized for it. He just wants to produce an audience that doesn't want to take the vaccine. And produce a situation, by the way, that you have to admit is pretty funny. Because if you are a fan of Fox News, what do you, of all of the stuff that happens involving the vaccine on there, what is it? It's, they don't give Trump enough credit for the vaccine. The vaccine's definitely gonna kill me. I don't wanna get it. Why doesn't Biden give Trump credit for the great work he did? It's a plot by Bill Gates to get circuits in your brain. Like seriously, they are bopping back and forth between those two things. Is it Trump's gift to mankind? Or is it a big scam that you should be very critical of? And yet they somehow do manage to maintain both of those positions simultaneously. But I will remind everyone again, Every single talking head on Fox is getting that vaccine as quick as they can, which you can bet your ass is a lot faster than you can. And don't want to die of COVID, so they're definitely getting it. They just don't care if you get it. And that should make you incredibly suspicious.
Which is weird because their demographic is dying out anyway. Let them tell it, right? You know, but the demographics of this country is changing, younger, browner, more progressive. And so you would think that they would want to care for their audience, but now they're like, no, it's more important for us to get these ratings than to protect our long-term investments. So yet again, they're demonstrating the capitalistic mindset. Worry about the quarterly profit margins, not the long-term enduring.
Exactly.
Well, I didn't finish that word properly, but you got it.
I get what you mean. Yeah. Oh God, I'm questioning whether to play this next video. I know. Okay. We'll move on. Are we not responsible here? Anyway, we're going to move on to our next one. And that is going to be possibly for the first time Ben Dixon being involved in this segment, but I'm very excited for it. So let's do this. And now it's time for news from around the world. And meanwhile, in Meanwhile, in Spain, they're doing something that I have been calling for literally years, experimenting with a 4-day work week. AJ Plus announced that they're going to be working on giving workers 32-hour weeks with no reduction in pay, and the government will be covering some of the costs for interested companies. Advocates say it could improve mental health and productivity and lead to a better work-life balance. It is not all of Spain, though, which some headlines have been very vague about. It is a trial that is going to involve companies amassing basically 3,000 to 6,000 workers, but it is expected that the trial will last for a couple of years. There's going to be some good data that's going to be collected, and the idea is that this will be a good test of what effect it actually has. Now, this won't be the first real trial, but it's the most specific for a 4-day work week. You've had things like other countries like Finland and New Zealand have explored a work week reduction. France adopted a 35-hour work week back in 2000. And individual employers, including Greenpeace Canada, have also experimented with a 4-day work week with full pay during the pandemic, which their executive director says it's the best. Our work is stronger than ever. Our staff feel more valued. They're healthier and more energized and more creative at work. Ben, what do you think about this experiment?
I love it. First and foremost, I'm just thinking it takes me back to high school. My senior year in high school was the first year that they tried the 4-day school week. And it just brings back fond memories of all the trouble I got into, good trouble on Fridays. But in terms of like mental health, yeah, I mean, we're clearly overworked in this country. We have this entire ethos of working until we die, that kind of mentality. And it's not always talking about how long we work until how old we get, but how intense we work during those 5 days. And because most of us are working around the clock when we're at home. So, I mean, I love the idea.
Yeah. Yeah, I like it. The interesting thing I found though is that we have talked about some of these other experiments in the past on TDR. And I personally said that I think it would be a great thing to experiment with. And I've noticed there's a lot of pushback, even from people in the working class. And I never really understood that. I mean, sure, there's people in the working class that also have been trained to be against raising the minimum wage and stuff like that. Like, like we are taught to sabotage ourselves. But I don't know, like I feel like when did we get the weekend? Like less than 100 years ago. But there was great work by labor activists and, you know, the whole movement, everything finally got us a weekend. It took us thousands of years of human society to get 2 days off. Okay, now we've been working really hard for decades and decades, and we're way more productive than we were. Do we ever get a third day? Why is everyone satisfied with we should never get more time off than we already do? Especially considering that in America, we get less sick time off, way less vacation time off. Why are we not fighting for a little bit more than our grandpa and grandma got back in the day? I've always thought that that's so weird.
That's a really good point. I'm just thinking that itself is a symbolic of how broken we are as Americans and how little we expect for our own selves. I often think about how is it that we allowed 548,000, someone corrected me, people to die from COVID-19 and we not like literally just tear this place apart limb by limb. And it's because I think we don't really value, we place more value on our jobs than we do our own personal lives. And I think that could be the only way to understand why we aren't asking for more, the way you framed it. I love that question.
Yeah, we're like trained to think, well, if we, you know, totally bash our head in our career, then eventually we'll have a good life. Yeah. But what if we could just have the good life? What about that?
Yeah.
Anyway, there is a correction from the audience. Let's see who sent it. Oh, Bread and Toast says, what's John talking about? The Weeknd was born in 1990. Don't bring up music on my show. Anyway, but meanwhile, in. Meanwhile, in Brazil, in response to a massive rise in COVID cases and deaths, they're having to switch up their approach a little bit with the Brazilian president, Jair Bolsonaro, on Monday naming a doctor as the country's new health minister, hours after the general currently in the role confirmed that Bolsonaro was weighing candidates to replace him. So you should understand that at this point, more than 279,000 Brazilians have died in a worsening outbreak that killed more people in Brazil than any other nation in the world last week. And you can see the daily deaths, how they've been spiking up recently. You know, just over the past week or two, they have shot up. And it's interesting because I remembered a bit of Bolsonaro related news from a couple weeks ago. And that was when he said at to a crowded event, enough fussing and whining. How much longer will the crying go on? How much longer will you stay at home and close everything? No one can stand it anymore. We regret the deaths again, but we need a solution. And it's so weird that the guy who approaches the pandemic as people not wanting those to die is whining or fussing or crying, and somehow more people end up dying. It's so weird how that works out, Ben.
The level of sociopathy. I often think, how bad can America get? Or is there anything worse than how we do politics here? And then I'm reminded of Bolsonaro and what's happening there. But we're not too far off in terms of just being blatant with that rhetoric. In fact, actually, no, I got to correct myself. We're right there with them in this level of derangement, political derangement, and complete dismissal of the value of human life. It is absolutely absurd where we've gotten in our global politics.
And you know, the funny thing is, obviously, like, there have been countries that have really failed on COVID. We're one, Brazil remains one. What's interesting is that, like, you know, I like reminders that we're all sort of similar at the end of the day. And the way the failure was managed looks pretty similar, at least on the surface. So the former health minister, General Eduardo Pazuello, an active duty army general without a medical degree, has been criticized for lacking public health expertise and supporting Bolsonaro's push to use unproven drugs to fight COVID-19 while downplaying the need for social distancing. The two predecessors before that resigned in roughly the span of a month last year, in part because as physicians, they wouldn't fully endorse treating COVID-19 patients with the anti-malarial drug hydroxychloroquine. So they've had so many people in charge of this, as the president is telling you to stop whining and just reopen. They've been trying to push things that don't actually treat it as the solution, while telling people you don't need to do things like social distancing, which is the solution. Are we really that different at the end of the day? Two countries, a world apart, but the same sort of stupid political leaders.
And the why? Like, they could have accomplished keeping businesses open when we found, like, it was just so efficacious for people to wear masks. And so they were like, okay, if you insist on people going on this pandemic in order for these companies to hit their quarterly profit margins, okay, I got a problem with that. But could you at least support wearing masks and social distancing? And that's a bridge too far. Not only do they want you to go out and spend your money, they want you to go out and risk your life.
Exactly. Exactly. Okay, at least briefly. Meanwhile, amidst surprisingly upbeat music, Vatican City has decided that they're not having it with same-sex marriages. So they want to pretend that they're like totally open to it and it's not judgy or anything. But interestingly, the Vatican said earlier this week that priests could not bless same-sex unions, calling any such blessing not licit, which I think is illicit. Do they not want to use the word illicit? Why are you saying not licit? But anyway, the ruling said that the church should be welcoming towards gay people, quote, with respect and sensitivity, but not endorse their unions. And what's interesting is that in the American context, in the US, where more than 6 out of 10 Catholics support same-sex marriage, according to a Pew survey from 2019, many gay Catholics and their advocates mourned the announcement and said it would inevitably lead to more gay people and those who support them leaving the church. And it's interesting, Ben, because the Pope at least has sort of put some signals out over the past couple of years that they were going to be changing a little bit on this. But at the end of the day, the Vatican position doesn't seem that different from the past.
Yeah, yeah. He's like, you know, I'm the cool Pope. I'm the progressive Pope. I'm not that progressive. Don't you go and bless any of these same sex marriages when they could have just shut up, right? We know where they stand on all these things. And we also know where they stand on covering up molestation of children. And so for me, it's like, I much would rather they just stay out of this instead of inserting their opinion in a way that is harmful and detrimental to so many people across the globe. But what good is a church if it's not going to do that? And I say that as a Christian.
Exactly. Yeah. And look, to some extent, being willing to accept like two people in a loving relationship shouldn't take any additional context, especially if like your whole life is about trying to consider what's moral and doing it. But for some reason, maybe I'm crazy, but I feel like following the last year, seriously? Seriously, so many people have died, and you're like, okay, that was rough. You guys suck again. Really? That's what you're spending your time. Like, we should be lucky that anyone's still alive.
Right.
And you're like, which marriage is the best and which is subpar? It just seems so out of touch with anything having to do with real life.
And it's so unnecessary. It is so unnecessary, especially in context of just like, this is the way I see it, man. It's so hard to find somebody to love you the way you want to be loved. Mm-hmm. If you find it and they're a consenting adult, then it's none of my damn business who that person is. And the church, the Catholic Church specifically, hell, churches in general, I mean, 50% of the divorces happen from Christians. They should understand that more than anybody else, how difficult it is to actually fall in love and be in love with somebody. They should be blessing all these marriages.
It's just such an easy thing to do to try to catch up a little bit to society.
Yeah.
And to send a strong signal to so many people who believe in you still as the ultimate arbiter of all that is true and moral, that maybe you should be a little bit more understanding and empathetic.
Yeah.
I don't know. I guess 2021, we're not there yet. Check back in a couple hundred years and we'll find out. Anyway, Ben, as always, thank you so much for joining the show. Always glad to have you on.
Hey, man, it was a pleasure. Hopefully, it won't be the next couple hundred years before I come back. As long as it's going to take for the church to get their stuff together.
Exactly. Now, where can people see your work? I mean, I know when they can see it is always, but where the can they see it?
They can see it. And since it's my birthday, apparently, why don't you guys give me a birthday present and go subscribe to the Benjamin Dixon Show channel and you can see our work around the clock. I do think I might be the hardest working man in independent media.
I think that that's indisputable. Perhaps we'll do a poll. But anyway, as always, thank you, Ben.
Hey, it's a pleasure, man. Take care.
Very excited to be joined on the program by a candidate for California State Assembly District 79, Aramique Glass Blake. Welcome to the Damage Report.
Thank you so much for having me. My pleasure.
We're very glad to have you on. And so we want to learn about your background, why you decided to run. But also, this is a slightly different circumstance in terms of the race. So can you tell us a little bit about what led to the race at this particular time and how that's going?
Definitely. So I am an equity and conflict resolution advisor. I do a lot of work around criminal justice and public safety reform. And I am a friend of the show. I was on a few years ago. I ran for Congress, but I ended up dealing with endometriosis and ultimately finding out I had cancer. And so this time last year, I was hospitalized fighting for my life.
Oh, wow.
And never thought I would run for office again. But once the governor appointed Dr. Shirley Weber as Secretary of State, after Kamala was, now our vice president, I decided to run, and I really had to have a conversation with my community. The 79th district is a very unique community in a sense of it's one of the most diverse districts within the country. And so I felt a need because of the opening, because I felt like the seat needed to be a Black woman but be the right Black woman. And so we're having a lot of conversations around equity versus representation, because here in San Diego, between multiple communities, the Black community keeps getting the short end of the stick. And right now in the dynamic, there's five other people running. It's a very interesting race because Dr. Shirley Weber's daughter is in the race, and she is a medical doctor and ran for La Mesa City Council, which is a city within San Diego County, on a lot of the platform, criminal justice platform, that I pushed forward. And so we see all of the candidates, except for myself, are pretty much a special interest. We have one lone Republican in the race who, if you watch back, knows nothing about what he's doing. And so we have four other, you know, candidates, Democrat candidates in the race. And really you just see special interest play out across the board. All of, you know, the constituents and people have this feeling of, we don't want, yes, we want it to be a Black woman, but we don't want this anointment into the seat after a mother leaves and then the daughter takes over. And we also don't want special interests around, I constantly talk about labor unions not being created equally. And some of the labor union leaders really making and creating backdoor deals. And so we have a labor person in, we have a establishment Dem who got all of their money from the establishment Sacramento. And then you have myself, who is the independent candidate running really on progressive views and values.
Well, first of all, I want to say sorry to hear about your health difficulties. Obviously difficult to deal with at any point, and during a pandemic, I can only imagine how much more difficult that becomes. It had to make the decision to run more difficult, but also the fact that it is a special election, it is a shorter time frame. You know, you don't have, you know, in theory, like a full year necessarily of campaigning and all of that. How does that shape a bit about the campaign, and in particular where you have a relative of the former office holder, does that change at all how you're communicating, how you're campaigning?
You know, it in the beginning we thought it would. You know, like I said, this district is very unique. So it is interesting because when I ran for Congress, all of the endorsements that that I received, you know, or that the daughter has now, I received when I ran previously, right? So those dynamics have changed where I am like the enemy. I've always gone against the establishment, but I am like truly the enemy to dare run, right? So that has changed. But then in this time of COVID, right, having to like reach out to people in unique ways and really tap into the connection to the community and being the voice of the voters, which I've always been. So for me, it's a very interesting dynamic because I'm very much connected to the 79th district. I, you know, am the only candidate who has worked on every issue throughout the district. So it, you know, I don't have the same money. I don't have the same resources. And really, I am the Black sheep of, you know, all of this. I was elected as a Dem recently, and we just seen how social media and really being connected to the voters helped me even get into the seat as an a Dem. And so we're using the same strategy, grassroots organizing, boots on the ground. You know, I am, you know, I'm healthy and cancer free. So, you know, my doctor said if I got vaccinated, I could go knock on doors. And so I'm, you know, boots on the ground, knocking on doors, talking to the voters, you know, doing it in the most safe way. But really, I don't have the luxury of sending out, you know, commercials and pamphlets and booklets. I mean, I think at this point, you know, one of the establishment candidates has sent out probably, I would say, 10 different pamphlets and booklets. It looks like literally a hospital magazine. And so we don't, you know, obviously when you're, you know, a grassroots candidate, you don't have those same privileges, right? And really, really tapping into the people to understand why we need election reform, why we need ranked choice voting, why we need publicly funded elections, because many times the people who are the most connected to the community, who do the most work, and who has worked across the board in just trying to take it to the next level on a state or federal level, don't even see the opportunity. People never even hear their name until they vote. And that's because the system is, you know, created that way. And so one of the things I constantly try to explain when talking to folks is that you don't have to be white to uphold white supremacy, and you don't have to be Black or a person of color to help dismantle it. And we see in all the different areas of our political system and ways that even people of color are tokenized and, you know, continue with the white supremacy system that we have. And so those are the things that I'm really addressing. We have a huge issue with education equity. We have a huge issue with economic development. This was all prior to COVID, right? So COVID just amplified the already deep issues that we have within our district. And so that's what I am bringing to the table, is really equity. I look at everything through an equity lens. How do we create policy that works for everyone? And how are we giving? And I say this all the time because, you know, the Democratic Party loves to say, we need equality. And I say, we need equity. Equality gives everyone the same thing. Equity gives people what they need. And we need to be meeting people's needs. And that's really specifically why I'm running, because I know how to create policy that works for folks, but also make sure our constituents and the voters actually feel, you know, our community feel the policy being passed.
Okay. And we want to make sure that people know that we've alluded to the quick time frame for this race a couple times, but the primary is going to be held on April 6th. That's just a couple of weeks away. You talked earlier about some of your campaign strategies. Are you actively looking for volunteers? Like, if people are watching and they want to get involved beyond just voting, how would you recommend doing that?
Definitely. So my and voting has started, by the way. Early voting has started. 300,000 people got their ballots, but people can go to vote4agb.com if they want to volunteer and text bank, phone bank. If they're actually here in San Diego, they can definitely, you know, do lip drop. My volunteers are not knocking on doors; they're only dropping lit. But ultimately, we really need our progressive folks and the folks that really, you know, believe in voting values and know that we need a shift to donate to the campaign, because I am the candidate who is only taking individual contributions. And, you know, going against the establishment is hard, but we're doing it. We're making a lot. You know, happen with a little.
Awesome. And anyone watching, the information for the website's also been on screen. Aramik, I want to thank you for joining us once again. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate you.
And best of luck to you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.